Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point, a monumentally bruising week all round. Panic, crash, more body blows to the U.S. and global economy, and punches flying hard and fast on the campaign trail. Around the world and on Wall Street, sell-off after sell-off. Here's New York trader David Henderson.
The damage has already been done, basically, and I think, you know, people aren't quite sure where everything's going to settle out.
Trailing in the polls, the McCain-Palin campaign turned harsh. Here's a light example. John McCain, Ohio, Wednesday.
I don't need lessons about telling the truth to the American people. And were I ever to need any improvement in that regard, I probably wouldn't seek advice from a Chicago politician.
In Cincinnati, Barack Obama fired back.
I can take four more weeks of John McCain's attacks, but I know this, America can't take four more years of John McCain's policies, George Bush's policies. We can't take that.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. How does this end? What should Washington and world leaders be doing to staunch the financial crisis? And what message for the future are you hearing from the campaign trail? Joining me from Washington is Zanny Minton-Beddoes. She's economics editor for The Economist and author of a big new 20-page special report on the world economic crisis in the issue that hits the newsstands today. Zanny Minton-Beddoes, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much.
With us from San Antonio, Texas, is Jibby Martinez, political columnist and contributor to Politico.com. Jibby Martinez, great to have you back as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Zanny, and Jibby.
Zanny, what a week. Saving the System, the giant headline on The Economist with your big piece inside. Give us your take on where are we right now at the end of this unbelievable week? How would you describe the U.S. economy, the global economy right now?
Well, I think the economies are still very much on the edge, and I think if I was redoing the cover of our magazine this week, I might put a question mark after saving the system. I think what we've seen this week is, and let me emphasize the positive, we've seen a very
Please.
Big change in the policymakers' attitude. And I think two things. We've realized that there has to be a concerted, cooperated, cross-country response to this. And secondly, there has to be a comprehensive one. We have to stem the panic, you have to recapitalize banks, and you have to do everything you can to cushion the effect on the real economy. And we're seeing the beginnings of that. I don't think it's enough yet, but we're seeing the beginnings.
Finance ministers meeting in Washington this weekend begin arriving already today. Here's British Prime Minister Gordon Brown yesterday in an interview with Sky News. Listen closely to what he says here. I want to ask you about it, Zanny. He says something must be done to stop the American financial crisis, not just this time, but crises maybe in the future, from affecting his country, Britain.
I've been talking to President Bush. I've been talking to European leaders. We'll have a world leaders meeting very soon, I think. We're going to have to get agreement on basic principles that underline a banking system. So what happens in America can no longer infect, because something has gone wrong there, what's happening in Britain.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes, what might that mean? He wants to change the banking system so that what happens in America can no longer infect what happens in Britain. That sounds like, I don't know, the beginning of the end of globalization, or what is it?
Well, with all respect to my prime minister, I think that he's expressing a very popular sentiment, which is that we need to change the system somehow so that we don't have these crises cascading across different countries. And there is a view out there, particularly in Europe, that this was something primarily made in America and somehow Europe is collateral damage. I actually think that that's a somewhat simplistic view of what's going on, and you're right, we live in a global world, and we live in a world of increasing financial globalization, and we have to figure out ways of making that world safer, but I don't think the answer is putting up barriers between countries.
But what is, when all these big shots get together this weekend, to perhaps the heads of state themselves soon, if this calamity continues to unfold, what can be done? We've seen all kinds of variations on bailout and rescue themes and plans in the U.S. this week. But globally, Zanny, is there something that a concert of nations can do to stop this? Or is this a forest fire that just goes?
Well, let's sort of take a deep breath and separate two things. One is to stem what is quite clearly a banking panic. And we've had banking panics throughout centuries. We had it a long time before Wall Street was invented.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to stem that panic, and that involves government stepping in. And I think, as I said earlier, I think we are seeing the inklings of a strategy to do that. Now, unfortunately, we've had a lot of ad hoc responses, and we've had a lot of countries doing different things at different times, not surprisingly, because mm-hmm. things are moving so quickly. But I think once markets get a sense that there is a coordinated, comprehensive policy response to stemming panic, that will eventually happen. Then I think once we've done that, we buy ourselves some time to recapitalize banks, to solve the underlying debt problem. And then the third part of it is to sort of step back and say, okay, how do we make the system more resilient? How do we change the rules so that we minimize the risks of this kind of stuff happening? But I think we should do that last bit with a fair degree of humility, because it's not simply, you can't simply say this was all the result of innovation on Wall Street now, and once we change the rules, everything will be fine. Finance is prone to excesses. It's prone to booms and busts, and we have to think hard how we can gain the benefits of finance while taming those excesses.
On the U.S. front, plans going from the bailout, which we were talking about passing just a week ago, to Hank Paulson talking about the U.S. government actually buying serious stakes, putting serious money into American banks. Nationalizing American banks is the word that's come out this week. Here's White House Press Secretary Dana Perino yesterday responding to a reporter's question about that possibility of the government buying stakes in U.S. banks.
It was a part of the rescue package that the president supported, and it gives the Treasury Secretary a range of possibilities, and investing in banks directly was one of those authorities, and Secretary Paulson can use that authority as he sees fit.
The U.S. government investing in banks directly. That is a big step, both materially and ideologically. Jibby Martinez, you're watching all this unfold from Texas, and of course it's unfolding in the middle of a presidential campaign. Are Americans ready for anything at this point? Is the bottom fallen out of the market far enough that people are ready for the most radical kinds of government intervention?
You know, Tom, what I see is the voters here are very, very angry. You know, I'm here in San Antonio in a what used to be a crimson red state, and I visited yesterday with the small business owner who hosted President Bush on Monday here in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pharmacy, Almas Pharmacy. And so she was in a small group of people who met with President Bush, and she told him, I'm pulling everything out of the stock market. I'm getting out. I've had it. And I asked her, well, what was your response? And she said that he said, give me 5 weeks. And she and her friend are retelling the story, and they just burst out laughing. It's like, you know, are you kidding me? You know, they just are so angry that things are so bad, and they don't really see a solution. And the, I guess the inclination here is to just flee the system and pray that something, you know, comes along soon. They don't have faith in anything right now.
Mm.
And it's kind of sad, you know. And I also was going around into some of the neighborhoods that have been in some of the affluent neighborhoods of San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And I see so many for sale signs up. And these are houses that where you would have had longstanding families stay there. I just think that the public is getting anxious and angry. Here in Texas, they're seeing ads for a U.S. Senate race that, you know, has had some elasticity. You think it's closing, and then it widens. The Republican senator is the incumbent, Cornyn, and then the presidential race. It's kind of like they wonder if they have a say in it because Texas is not considered a battleground state. So it's interesting to actually watch it from this point where people are hoping something will happen, but they can't see it yet.
Jack Beatty, there's George Bush in his home state, Texas, mm-hmm. saying, give me 5 weeks, and you hear that voter's response. No way, of course, in 5 weeks we'll have a new president-elect in this country. How do you see the unbelievable magnitude of this financial crisis, banking crisis, economic crisis bleeding into the campaign, Jack?
Well, I think that Jibby puts your finger right on it. It's the resentment that's out there. It's massive, and I think it boils up in a kind of rancid populism, a kind of, you know, you can hear it even in some of the reactions to Obama at these rallies. And, you know, it may turn out that John McCain's coming out for this bailout bill was as significant in its way as Wendell Willkie's coming out for, you know, the destroyer deal in 1940 and coming out for the Selective Service Act in 1940, which Roosevelt said that if he hadn't done, Roosevelt might have lost on the issue. That internationalism took the question of Hitler off the agenda. Well, this isn't anything as big as that, but we do have this, the fact that McCain has come over against the majority in his party to back this bill removes that anger, I think, from the presidential campaign. It's out there. It's finding other expressions. But imagine if he had come out against the deal. He would now be riding that resentment even more strenuously than now. And it wouldn't just be directed at Obama. It would spill over, as I think it already is, blaming minorities for taking these loans. The thing would get ugly, even uglier than what we're seeing.
But, of course, that's not the case. He's behind the bailout, which puts both presidents behind it. But Zanny Mittenbettos, nobody knows exactly what the so-called bailout's going to look like at this point. I mean, a week ago we thought we had an idea, but now it all seems in play. Exactly who's going to be doing what, on what scale? We had not heard the end of intervention here by any means, have we?
No, we haven't. And I think which things are happening so fast that the direction thing the Treasury used, there, $700 billion, it is changing fast. As you know, there's been a move in the past couple of days to go along the lines that the Europeans have, which is to inject capital directly into banks.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the flexibility that the Treasury has makes a lot of sense. But the problem in part now is that there are actually a lot of actions underway, which once they start being put into effect, whether it's the Fed buying commercial paper or whether it's the Treasury putting capital into banks, will in fact make a difference. But because it's been, because the panic is so extreme, because the markets are moving so fast, there is a sense that the policymakers are not in control, that they're reacting, that they're doing things on the fly, and that doesn't do anything to instill confidence. I mean, when you have a panic, it's the most important thing is to somehow give a sense that government knows what it's doing, that policymakers have their arms around it.
And for now, we're on the fly, looking at the week. Zanny, please stand by. Jimmy Martinez in Texas, Jack Beatty. We're looking at the week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour at the end of an amazing week about global crash, fierce politics, and a long, difficult week in the news. Zanny Mittenbettos joins us from The Economist, economics editor there. The big headline this week, Saving the System. She says at the end of this week she'd put a question mark after it. Jimmy Martinez of Politico.com is with us from San Antonio, Texas, and Jack Beatty's here. John McCain on Wednesday outside Cleveland with his proposal from the Tuesday night debate to have the government come directly to the aid of people's whose homes have been of lost value, who can't meet their monthly payments. Of course, it would mean directly to the aid of the banks who made those loans as well.
The United States government will purchase mortgages directly from homeowners and mortgage services and replace them with manageable mortgages. The dream of owning a home should not be crushed under the weight of a bad mortgage.
Yesterday in Portsmouth, Ohio, Barack Obama criticized that plan to use federal funds to buy distressed mortgages.
When we woke up Wednesday, we found out he wants to have the government pay the full face value of mortgages on the books of these banks and lending institutions, even though they're not worth that much anymore. So what that means is it would guarantee you, the American taxpayers, would hand over $300 billion to underwrite the kind of greed and irresponsibility on Wall Street that got us into this mess.
Zanny Mittenbettos, I'm not sure what keeps up with the scale of the crisis at this point, but on Tuesday night it was news when John McCain threw his weight behind this idea, that is to buy lots of bad mortgages quickly from the banks and then put together refinance packages for the mortgage holders, homeowners. How is this being received by economists, by markets? Does this look like a good idea, a bad idea? You heard Obama criticizing it there.
Well, I think the specifics of how Senator McCain has proposed it, which is the buying the mortgages at 100% of face value, does reward those who made the most reckless loans and does set some very strange incentives. That said, the notion that you have to address the underlying debt problem, I think, is an important one. And there have been several initiatives already to try and help homeowners who have mortgages that they cannot afford. But I think an important component of that is that you if you are going to buy the mortgages, you buy them at some kind of a write-down.
Now, if that's not big enough to turn this around, and it's starting to feel dwarfed, when leaders sit down in Washington, finance ministers, what kind of coordinated moves or announcement might they be contemplating, Zanny? What might they come up with here?
Well, I think there are several strategies that we're seeing now come together. And I would say one is to find ways to, as I said earlier, to stem the panic, particularly in the interbank market. And there are two ways of doing that. One is the strategy that the Federal Reserve is following, which is increasingly to be the lender of first resort and to be the place that you could go to get liquidity.
Commercial paper, whatever it is, your business needs money, go straight to the Fed. Unprecedented, but they're doing it.
Straight to the Fed. Mm-hmm. The other way of trying to stem panic is by simply issuing a guarantee, and that's what the Europeans have gone down. The UK announced a couple of days ago that it would guarantee banks' short-term liabilities. So if banks borrowed money, it would be guaranteed. That's another possibility. The second thing, but I don't think those guarantees are an end in themselves. The second strategy, you have to figure out ways to get capital to banks that are short of capital. So that could be government injections of capital. It could be ways of inciting private sector capital. And then the third part is for the policymakers, the G7 leaders, to make clear that they are doing everything they can to cushion their economies from this very real financial shock, from this kind of heart attack in the credit markets. And that's where the rate cut on Wednesday was a start. I suspect there'll be more like that, and I suspect we'll be seeing more fiscal levers move too. But I think the important thing is it's not so much that they come out with a particular new proposal today, but that they make clear that they all agree on a broad strategy, that there are various components of it, and that they're all working on those components together.
But do these governments, whether they head up the biggest economies in the world or smaller ones but acting in concert, I mean, do they have the capacity to staunch a panic like this once it's begun? Ben Bernanke, great student of the Great Depression, so he's got the big lessons in mind. But I mean, just is there enough, I don't know, is there enough money in the bucket, even if they all work together, to stop this, Sammy?
Yeah, I think they can. I haven't completely lost faith in policymakers' ability to do that. I think they've all learnt the lessons from the Great Depression, and I think they are showing very powerfully that they will do everything that it takes to stop it. It hasn't completely worked yet, but I think we're at the beginning stages of this, and I think they are throwing the book at it. They're willing to throw the book at it, and they will staunch the panic. The problem is that they're working, 24/7. Mm-hmm. They're all in their different countries. They're all exhausted, and they give the impression of an ad hoc kind of on the run approach. When what they really need is you need the sort of metaphorical, the equivalent of somebody going out and giving the calming speech and saying, it's okay, we understand, we are going to sort this out. And it's hard to do. I'm very confident that they will. In fact, I have no doubt that they will. But it's tough to give that message when you're all scurrying around in your corners.
Jibby, that sounds like FDR's, 4-day bank holiday and big speeches of the 1930s. Do you see the leader in the White House or on the campaign trail or maybe at the Treasury Department who can do that?
Well, President Bush is going to be speaking on this issue in a little while.
Speaking this morning,
I'm anxious.
Yes.
Right, I'm anxious to hear what he's going to say because so far he hasn't said anything that's resonated with the everyday, small business owner or homeowner who's facing foreclosure. I mean, there's just so much cynicism out there. I will say one thing about the John McCain plan. Obama is trying to cast that, and I think correctly so, as a plan that would help the banks and other institutions that hold the mortgages and gave bad mortgages, and by letting the government pay these off at the current value instead of discounted value that they are now, that they're worth now. When Obama talks about this, he makes it clear that this is in effect helping the big guys again. And any time that a voter hears that, I think it helps Obama and hurts McCain. McCain makes it sound like he's trying to help the homeowner. But what the homeowners understand is in this crisis, it's the big guys, it's the corporate giants, the ones who can have vacation homes in Florida and get facelifts and all of that. Those are the ones that the people are really angry about. And they don't want anything that's going to cut them any deals or breaks or anything like that anymore. And the campaign that can effectively tap into that sentiment, I think, will win in the final weeks of the campaign.
Let's go to our listeners. Judy in Acton, Massachusetts. Judy, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am one of those small business owners. I am a craft artist. I sell my work at galleries across the country and shops. And frankly, I've seen the weakness of the middle class for years now. I've been doing this for 5 years, and from what other people tell me, since 9/11, the industry has been in a lot of pain and struggle. And this is really scary to a lot of people in my business. We can, for years, it was items that were very inexpensive, and items that were very high in price sold the best.
But you're in the craft business. That means maybe sitting at home putting bracelets together and macrame.
Right.
That sounds like hard times entertainment. Maybe that's what we'll all be doing.
It's a business. It's a business. I sell to 60 shops and galleries across the country who many of them are struggling.
Are they buying? Are they canceling orders?
They're canceling orders. Yes, they are. My sales are down dramatically from last year.
Wow.
And after having a good surge at the beginning of the year, I was ahead of last year.
Judy, hang in. If this is tough times, you may be the first on the comeback trail. Let's get another here from Augusta, Georgia. Gloria, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm calling because I want to hear from the people who have been predicting this downturn for the last 3 years. And yet they never get any airtime, like Dean Baker, like Paul Krugman. We're still hearing from the people who said everything was hunky-dory. And yet they were wrong, and yet we're still hearing their opinions.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear their opinions.
Yeah, Gloria, thanks for your call. We've heard from both of those right here. Jack Beatty, what about who's getting the microphone now, and who's going to end up giving us the narrative of where the country and its economy and the world are headed?
Well, if I may be forgiven a parochial moment, Gloria, we actually, this program over the last almost 2 years has been talking about this crisis and really talking about it in a very serious key. So if you've been listening to our air, you heard people saying it's bad. And in a way, it's come out even worse than some of our guests imagined. Who will give the narrative on this? It won't be John McCain. I mean, that's just clear now. I mean, you mentioned this mortgage plan. Well, the original plan on Tuesday night had this clause in it that the lenders must recognize the loss they've already suffered. That is, the banks must take a beating. That was rubbed out in the website the next morning. And it turned into what essentially was a bailout to these banks, and the Center of American Progress points out that McCain has taken $1.5 million from the mortgage industry in this year alone, and the 21 of his top aides and fundraisers have lobbied for mortgage companies. So maybe that was a simple mistake, but I think we see there why he isn't the person who's going to be speaking to it. I think for Obama, there is a different kind of problem, and political scientists are already talking about this. I won't say he's soothing, but he's certainly telling people we're going to get through this, and his manner is calm, and one can believe that he's not ruffled by it. But some people are saying, oughtn't you get the people ready for what's going to happen the day after the election? Oughtn't you be telling them now, look, we may have to have more sweeping tax increases to pay for this. There may have to be sacrifices. Shouldn't you begin while the people can choose to give them a clue to the coming reality? And, of course, then the political people say, you do that, and McCain has a big issue. But it'll be interesting to see whether Obama is a little less soothing as his lead, which seems now to be, I won't say inexorable, but certainly formidable as that lead and if that lead grows.
Formidable, but it ain't over till it's over. Let's go to Suzanne in Des Moines, Iowa. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been a devoted reader of The Economist since around 2000,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of foretold of this big calamity, I think, during the first 4 years of the Bush administration when they were pointing out that maybe not that our culture is reckless, but that certainly a huge federal deficit, huge overspending, and a newfound weakening in the dollar that caused the dollar to lose its position as a standard of exchange for the world. I mean, it almost seemed inevitable. And then we had an administration who allowed overheating or deregulation of the economy to compensate for all these deficits. It seemed to just, bring the problem to a head.
Suzanne, let us pick that up. Zanny, have we sleepwalked into this? Have you and others been warning about it for all those years? Certainly, I mean, it feels like after years of being told we have fundamentals out of whack, the fundamentals themselves are speaking to us now, and very sternly.
Well, it's certainly true that we were warning about housing bubbles in, I think we had our first cover on a housing bubble in 2003, and we got a lot of flack over the subsequent years, and people would say to me, well, you know, even a stop clock is going to be right twice a day, so I'm sure eventually you'll be right, but, you know, what's all this doom and gloom about? And we have been consistently pretty doom and gloom filled. That said, you know, we did not predict the contours of this calamity precisely, and I don't think anybody did, and the scale of it and the global nature of it has certainly been something that's come as a surprise to a lot of people. We, you know, the aftermath of housing busts, the aftermath of asset busts is painful. And, you know, there's been a lot of systemic banking crises in history. Then we can look at what happens, whether it's Japan, whether it's Sweden, whether it's any number of emerging economies. And consistently, you see several things. One is that the costs to the economy are very big, can be very big. Secondly, that it takes a long time for the economy to recover. This is not going to be a kind of two-quarter recession and then we're fine. It's going to take a lot longer than that. But thirdly, and I think this is the most important thing to remember right now, that government intervention is important. When you have a systemic banking crisis, if the government steps in early enough and on a sufficient scale, you can reduce the cost of the crisis. And I think that, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for people's anger, and I have a lot of sympathy for the sense that, you know, there's anger about using public money. That said, it's really the least cost way of doing things. And if you don't do that, you end up in a much, much bigger mess.
Yeah, but so far we're talking about big public dollars and nothing really staunching the meltdown. Let's get a call from Rob in Boston. Rob, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Tom, one of the things that I'm not hearing, I'm kind of wondering, you talked about it a little bit about the banking holiday the FDR had. We have put $800 billion of our tax dollars into the system to try to fix Wall Street, and I'm hearing that nothing is really going to happen for about a month, and that's panicking a lot of people. Why can't we shut down trading on Wall Street for a month until all of this money settles in and things start to play out as they're predicted? It seems like the crash, or the so-called crash, and the dive in the market is what's really, really driving this panic. And unless we can stop that, then it's not going. Nothing's going to happen.
Rob, let's look exactly at that. Zanny, what about it? Is there a way to throw the brake right now, even though we're at this awkward political transition time, even in the month before an election? Is there a way to do something bigger, faster than we've seen so far?
Well, I guess I'm slightly less apocalyptic than the caller on this, and I think we are going to see things improving even over the next few days. And I think we need to separate two things. Mm-hmm. One, what's going on in the equity markets, and two, what's going on in the credit markets. And the real link in the short term to the economy is the credit markets. Mm-hmm. If businesses can't get credit, then we see the economy essentially shutting down and shutting down quite quickly. But I think a lot of the programs that have been put in place in the last couple of, essentially this week, are going to kick in. And we are seeing some signs of some unfreezing in certain corners of the credit markets, not much. But if that continues, then I become much, much more optimistic. And I try, you know, what's going on in the stock market is extremely important, but I think that can also turn around quite quickly too.
Jibby, do you feel that readiness to sort of dig in with a little patience, or what about the readiness to sacrifice? Can you imagine American voters right now responding positively to a call from McCain or Obama for real sacrifice to make it through what could be an extended tough time?
You know, I almost think that the voters would be more ready for it than the candidates themselves. It would be such a political, you know, nightmare. I don't even want to think about that happening only for that reason. They're already pretty tough on each other. But, you know, I do think that the voters do want solutions. And, you know, I was talking to someone else the other day who said, we used to be the country that could do things. We never expected to be in this position. What happened? And it's very easy for them to blame the Bush administration because we also were spending money on a war that, you know, lost a lot of popularity. And the priorities just seem to be wrong. And now we have energy crisis. And it seems like there's just so much going on and so much on the plate, they can't get their handles on it. And that's what they want, is some message from some leader that says, we're going to get through this. That's what they need.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. Gallows humor, dark jabs, and Nobel Prizes this week. Here's David Letterman.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Bush administration is taking over the banks. So, hey, crisis over. There we go.
Saturday Night Live here, channeling Joe Biden.
I love John McCain. He is one of my dearest friends. But at the same time, he's also dangerously unbalanced.
And the Swedish Academy announcing this year's Nobel Prize for Literature got some sensual ecstasy in the news.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2008 is awarded to the French writer Jean-Marie Gustave Le Clézio, author of New Departures, Poetic Adventure, and Sensual Ecstasy, explorer of a humanity beyond and below the reigning civilization.
There you go. We're talking about global crash, fierce politics, and a week in the news. Zanny Mitten-Beddoes is here from The Economist, Jibby Martinez from Politico.com, and Jack Beattie. Let's go to Scott in Nashville, New Hampshire. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk about anger with regard to the economic crisis. To my mind, there's a huge trust hole. It's not even so much anger, but trust. We've had a dozen or more years of deliberate undermining in confidence in federal government being able to do anything. And we've also seen a huge widening of the gap between the haves and have-nots. So in whatever plan is being proposed here, somebody's going to be making a lot of money. Somebody's going to be left footing the bill. And I think the trust issue that A, the government can do anything, and B, that the people who shouldn't be making out like bandits in this will, in fact, be making out like bandits. So I wonder, how can this trust be regained? Because we're not going to go anywhere. Economics and
yep.
markets are so emotional. We're not going to go anywhere until trust is regained.
It's the bottom line currency, isn't it, in a way? President Bush, of course, this morning in the Rose Garden, saying that anxiety among investors and the public is making the credit crisis more severe, trying to be reassuring, saying we're going to work closely with our partners from around the world. We're in this together. We'll come through this together. Let's hear how his potential successors each is talking on the campaign trail, talking about trust. Here's Barack Obama yesterday in Cincinnati he went after McCain's reaction, saying it was deeply inadequate on the financial crisis.
I don't think we can afford that kind of erratic and uncertain leadership in these uncertain times. We need steady leadership in the White House. We need a president we can trust in times of crisis.
Talking about erratic and uncertain and looking for trust at a John McCain rally in Albuquerque earlier in the week on Monday. The crowd got ugly in response to some of McCain's rhetoric. One audience member shouted out that the Democratic candidate was a terrorist.
What does he plan for America? In short, who is the real Barack Obama? But my friends, you ask such questions, and all you get in response is another angry barrage of insults.
John McCain in Albuquerque. Jibby Martinez, that's getting down your way. Who is the real Barack Obama, he asked, and you heard terrorist come back from the crowd. This is getting a long way from trust, a long way into ugliness on the campaign trail, Jibby.
Very ugly. I mean, I think we all assumed that we'd get to this point sooner or later, but it is uglier than even I thought, and that it has to be. I think it's a responsibility of the candidates, though, to when they hear someone shouting things like that, they should say, okay, wait, hold on, you know, let's not go that far. Except that is what McCain wants the voters to hear, that, you know, that Barack Obama used to pal around with a domestic terrorist. And I think that the Obama campaign is responding because they have to, in the sense that, you know, they feel like John Kerry didn't respond well enough 4 years ago, and Democrats always seem to lose when they get swift-boated and do nothing about it. I guess the question is going to come down in the last debate that they do. And hopefully the question will be asked about the kinds of campaigns they've been running and if, in fact, were they what they promised that they would be when they first started out 16 months ago. But Jack, it's nasty.
Jack, it is rough out there. Let's listen for just a moment to another piece of that. I mean, this is the whole Bill Ayers controversy, former weatherman, underground member who served on boards with Obama in Chicago. The McCain campaign making a lot of that in recent days. Here's Palin in Carson, California, last Saturday. Well, you can hear it.
Our opponent is someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country.
And she goes on here in that same appearance in Carson, California.
Turns out one of his earliest supporters is a man who, according to the New York Times, was a domestic terrorist and part of a group that, quote, launched a campaign of bombings that would target the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol.
Jack Beatty, we're getting a lot of volatile elements out here at the same time, severe economic uncertainty, and then this kind of deeply barbed attack on the Democratic candidate at the same time.
We are, and it's a manifestation of what Richard Hofstadter famously called the paranoid style in American politics, the heated exaggeration, the suspiciousness, the conspiratorial fantasy, the idea that because Obama served on a couple of boards, one of them sponsored by Walter Annenberg, Reagan's ambassador, to Britain, and with Republicans, that somehow this infected him with terrorism, is just an appeal to bigotry. But it even exists. You know, you get it you hear these vials of wrath opening in these rallies, but you also see it in the so-called sophisticated press. An article right now in the National Review calls Obama a closet Maoist, that he's working to Bill Ayers was a Maoist and now Obama is, and he's working to undermine our institutions, and you know, this is a plot to, I tell you, in the right in America, conservatism never fails. It is failed. The image is always one of betrayal. Someone has betrayed us. Someone is to blame. And you can hear that out there. You can especially hear it with Palin, who is an embodiment of this kind of backlash. I mean, David Brooks, a conservative, called her a cancer on the Republican Party because she stands for that know-nothingism, for that bigotry, for that, you know, we don't have to even think. It's enough to just say he's a, you know, he saw Bill Ayers. Forget about the $1 trillion loss in your 401k. Forget about all that. Bill Ayers. It's like something out of I don't know, the Manchurian Candidate or something. It's a very frightening moment.
Here's another bit of it from Waukesha, Wisconsin. McCain criticizing Barack Obama's for that same association with Bill Ayers yesterday.
Senator Obama said he was just a guy in the neighborhood. We know that's not true. We need to know the full extent of the relationship because of whether Senator Obama is telling the truth to the American people or not. That's the question.
Boy, we need to know. In St. Joseph, Missouri yesterday, Biden called out McCain for his attacks on Obama.
All of the things they said about Barack Obama in rallies and on TV before the debate, and all of the things that they're saying right now after the debate, John McCain couldn't bring himself to look Barack Obama in the eye and say at the debate. And folks, in my neighborhood where I came from, you got to say something to a man, look him in the eye and say it to him.
All right, let's keep our cool here. Zanny Mittenbeddoes of the UK, be our third-party referee here. Do you see a closet Maoist in the plans of Barack Obama?
Of course not. I mean, there's
I mean,
nothing any,
anything
to say.
Like it. I'm not sure what to say about it. But you've looked closely at what's being proposed on by both parties in this campaign. Is there anything that's outside of the kind of mainstream, broad of 20th century and beyond of you know, your capitalist country, our capitalist country?
Of course not. And there's no more to be said about it. I mean, it's completely absurd. I was struck by, though, the use of the caller who worried about the loss of trust. And as I was listening to this conversation that you were having about the two candidates, it seems to me that loss of trust goes, it's not just in our politicians and our political institutions, but it's actually at the heart of this whole financial mess, right? I mean, credit markets are about trust. And once you've lost trust, then the whole system freezes up. And that's really what we've had. We've got it writ large in the sort of broader political system, but we've got it really very intensively right now. What's going on Wall Street and internationally is a huge loss of trust from one institution doesn't trust another institution. No one knows who's lost what money. No one knows who will survive. And I think something that has added to that, particularly in the past few weeks, and this gets back to the politicians, mm-hmm. is that there's a sense that the game changed. You know, when Lehman was allowed to fail, mm-hmm. that was a change of policy. And suddenly people in the markets, and I'm not being an apologist for people in the markets, but I'm saying that they saw the rules change. And they didn't. Now they don't know who's going to fail, who's not going to fail. And as a result, you've injected uncertainty. And I think on many different levels now, you've got a very profound loss of trust. And the most important thing is to start trying to find a way to rebuild that.
Zanny, The Economist has over the years editorially, in its editorials, been very supportive of globalization and free markets. What kind of reaction to this meltdown do you think we may see in the world? Are we going to end up with a very different system here? I'm looking at headlines, Washington Post today, the end of American capitalism, question mark. I mean, how far does the response go?
That's somewhat exaggerated. You're absolutely right. We have been, and we still are indeed, extremely supportive of markets and of globalization. How far we shift the balance between markets and government in response to this, I think will be a consequence less of ideology and more of the effect on the economy. If you look back at the Depression, that there was a very profound shift, not just in finance, but in a whole swaths of the economy. But that was in response to a devastating 4 years. 25% unemployment, a third output loss. Just to go back to the caller earlier who talked about the bank holiday that mm-hmm. Roosevelt mm-hmm. began his presidency with, that was 3.5 years after the Wall Street crash of 1929, and it was 3.5 years in which the economy collapsed. Now, we are in a tough time right now, but we are nothing like that. And the one thing that gives me enormous cause for optimism is that politicians are acting, policymakers are acting very, very early on in this. And that's why I think we're not going to go down those dire straits. And if we don't go down those dire straits, and if we actually have we're going to have a downturn, but it's not a cataclysmic one, then I think the redrawing of the balance between government and markets will be less dramatic than people are now talking. So it won't be the end of capitalism.
Zanny, we'd like to trust you on exactly that.
Tom, we're also going down some strange ideological paths, aren't we? There's a headline in a British paper this week, "We are all socialists now." Not quite. But this is socialism to cushion, from disaster. It's the socialism. It's the socialization of risk, and many.
You're talking about U.S. government intervention
that's
already.
Right. Mm. That's right. That's right. And and Gordon Brown's idea of the £50 billion injection of money into the British banking system. These are remedies that are tantamount really to the kind of thing we saw in the Depression. And the question beyond this, it seems to me, is, if the government is taking these kinds of stakes in companies, what are the broader implications of that? Does that mean anything to do with the company's practices, their bonuses, their pay discrimination, their layoffs, their health care policies? In other words, if the government becomes an owner, what will the government insist on? There's a moment here where you could argue that just by dealing with this crisis, willy-nilly, the next administration is going to have a large say over equity in our society.
Mm-hmm. Jibby, let me come to you, but I want to get a couple calls here while we can. Renee in Milton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Renee.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Well, what do you see?
I'm glad I got through. I am so deeply disturbed with what I'm hearing in terms in the political world, the comments that are being made, and the way that I believe the Republicans, McCain and Palin, are using anger and resentment and kind of a veiled racism to try to stir up people's emotions against Barack Obama. And I think you have to understand, just as an ordinary black person, when we hear these things, we take them personal, because it's not just an attack on one man. It's really a lack of understanding about who black people are.
But Renee, do you think the economy is bigger than all that? Will it push that kind of rubbish to the side because the moment we're in is so difficult, people will just sober up and get down to business? Or are you afraid it will churn up more?
The economy is even very much involved in it, because even now they're trying to come out more and more and say that the root of the problem is the subprime and who took out these subprime loans. where even though there may be a problem with subprime loans, I think the real problem has to deal with the greed that took these subprime loans and turned them into something that has caused this cataclysmic failure of confidence.
Renee, good. Our time is short. Thanks for your call. Jimmy Martinez, do you think voters are going to push through this, past the kind of anger response to a cool-headed response, wherever they come down with that, McCain or Obama, will they be deciding on how do we save our bacon here or something else?
Well, let me give you an example of what happens with the Latino voter, which I think is similar to what's happening with the black voter. First of all, the economic crisis is also a class crisis. I mean, we're seeing that the classes are really separating out more broadly here. Now, the Hispanic voter is very concerned about the way the Republican Party has talked about immigration. Even if you're a legal citizen here and were born here, if they start talking anti-Hispanic, it bothers them. So the economy is the number one issue, but the motivating factor, that one thing that hangs behind in the back of their head, is how they have been treated as a class of people. And what the Democrats are hoping is that that will drive the voters, new voters, young voters, citizen voters, to the polls in unprecedented numbers. And I think what's happening with the McCain campaign is at one time they thought they could get some of these independent and ethnic voters, but they decided at some point earlier in the summer to just take a hard right drive and run their campaign to the base and get the base whipped up enough that they would show up, even though they have not always been fond of McCain. But they like Palin, and they like the rhetoric.
Well, Jack, home stretch now. What do you see dominating? Americans really care about their economic futures. Are they going to be, in a bloody rage of anger or looking for the solution to get out of this panic?
I hope they're going to find a solution, but I think it's going to come out of trial and error. That's what happened to the New Deal. There was no plan. It was just trying to keep ahead of the crisis, and I'm afraid that's what government is going to be doing for the next several years.
Well, and that's where we are right now, and no two ways about it. I want to thank each of you for being with us. Jibby Martinez with Politico.com joining us from San Antonio, Texas. Jibby, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Zanny Mittenbeto, it's always great to have you. Listeners, look for the big cover, Saving the System. She might put a question mark on it today. Zanny, thank you for your time today with The Economist.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, the best things in life are free, Jack, remember.
I will.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.